Hi, this is Brigitte Moucher with the Solari Wellness Series. Today, I'm talking again with Dr. Sarika Cernohaus, with whom we spoke a few weeks ago about healthy nutrition on a budget. Today, I wanted to talk about the dangers of fad diets and anti-nutrients. I would also like to spend a few minutes at the end answering questions we received from subscribers after the first interview. Sarika, welcome again to the Solari Wellness Series.
Brigitte, I'm so happy to be here with you again and with everyone too. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for making the time again.
Of course.
So let's start by saying maybe that we don't need to be on a diet to have a healthy diet, right?
I would prefer folks don't frame it that way. Yes, it's about a lifestyle. I think that just the feeling of the word diet, just conjures up constriction, something that has limitations, something that you have to follow. It's rule-based. And it's something that in the design of how most of us would probably think of it, really has a terminal aspect to it, an ending. Yes. And I think that growing up over the last, 40, 50, 60 years around these concepts of diet, like grapefruit diets and cabbage soup diets, and, these sorts of things to get people to lose weight, it's a short-term effort. And to your point, I just think it's so incredibly impactful to begin to just think about the nutrient choices that you make as just an important part of your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So that it's not something that has an end game to it, has this terminal end to it. And that it's something that is just part of the warp and weave of who and what you are in a way that feels very natural and comfortable and really is built around giving you incredible vitality.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are still going to go to look at, all those trendy diets out there. Some are definitely better than others. And I thought it would be useful to understand what's good, not so good, or bad about those the most popular diets. So it seems like keto is probably the most popular one these days, especially for weight loss, and definitely great short term. Yeah. And then paleo is also very popular, and it's sometimes hard to know exactly what the differences are between the two.
Yeah.
So I'd love to have your opinion on these, especially when you look at them with your medical background and the perspective of Chinese medicine and Ayurveda.
Sure.
So what are the advantages?
Yeah. I think it's fun to kind of frame this from a historical perspective.
Uh-huh.
And when we think about what really became very popular in the 1980s, in 90s, it was all about fat makes you fat. And so fat was removed from the foods that people were eating and everything became low fat and non-fat. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, I remember this product called Butter Buds. And
yeah,
it was
margarine.
Yes. That, you put onto things, add a little water to it, and it becomes the thing you put on your potato or whatever. So we were really far culturally into this non-fat paradigm. And we did that for quite some time. And the interesting thing about it was that in that same period of time, if you look at statistics, people just started really across the board gaining more weight.
Mm-hmm.
From a Chinese medicine perspective, when you take away healthy fat from the diet, you're taking away one of the cornerstones of nutrition that really has in its nature what we would call more of a yin aspect Something that really helps with the fluid tissue aspects of the body versus qi. And a lot of people are familiar with the term qi, you know, and that generally is indicative of something relative to energy. Well, yin is more the substance side of that. And when you take away one of the three macronutrients, and so macronutrients are those larger groupings of nutrition where we have fat, carbohydrate, and protein. When you take away one of those macronutrients, which in the 80s and 90s was fat, you have to fill in the void over here in the protein and the carbohydrate. Yeah. So what you're doing in that instance is you're really bringing things quite out of balance yeah. for what the human body is designed to work with in terms of macronutrition. And so what ended up happening is that these products were very full in very simplified carbohydrates and a lot of flavorings and enhancers to make the texture feel like it maybe had some fat to it, but it didn't. Yeah. And you can fool the body for only so long. It's an interesting thing because when we take the body down to its most basic composition anatomically, you know, we're talking about the cell and the cell membrane of every cell in your body is comprised of a fatty lipid structure. That's part of the membrane structure. And it is within that structure that we have the receptors on the cell membrane that allow for the communication with what's in the bloodstream back into what is in the cell. And when that goes missing, in terms of the composition of what the cell is needing for its cell structure, over time, that's going to be quite damaging to the body. And it's an interesting thing because one of the big discussion points around that time also was, you know, fat is bad, fat makes you fat, and cholesterol was also a villain as well. And what will happen is the body, even if you bring in no cholesterol, if you eat no animal products, which are the source of cholesterol in our diet, you can't get cholesterol from plant products. The body, the liver, will actually create cholesterol because cholesterol is such an important component of healing the body. It's like the, you know, the patchwork where there's injury throughout the, you know, the cardiovascular system and the brain, all of this. So the body, that's how important cholesterol is.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the big fallacies, you know, I feel like we're still recovering yeah. from. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big deal. And so when you bring in a lot of refined carbohydrate into the diet, one of the outcomes research has shown is that it tends to lend itself toward this systemic low-grade chronic cellular inflammation. And so that cell membrane that we were talking about, I like to think of it as like a puffer fish. And the puffer fish, when the puffer fish in the ocean is happy, the little tines on the puffer fish, you know, they're soft and he's kind of feeling what the world feels like. And then when the puffer fish becomes startled or scared or threatened, it puffs up and those tines become blunted and it becomes a much bigger fish. It appears to be a much bigger fish. Mm-hmm. That's how I think of the cell membranes when they have been under chronic assault because of different stresses. And one of the big stresses that we really brought into the human experience for over a decade, and for many people, they continue to, is a super low fat diet. You're not bringing in the nutrition that the cells need at that level of the cell membrane, and you're bringing in this boatload of refined carbohydrates, sugars, generally synthetic components that the body has to contend with, and it gets the cells into this chronic cellular inflammatory pattern. Mm-hmm. And so, that's kind of a historical view of like where we were. So I feel like the pendulum really swung in, you know, the 80s and 90s. And then Atkins, Dr. Atkins, his work, you know, was really a high fat, pretty high protein diet.
Yeah.
Very low carbohydrate. And I feel like that was a bit of a precursor to what we, many people would consider the ketogenic diet today, the popular ketogenic diet, and aspects possibly of the Paleolithic diet also.
Yeah.
So his work became kind of a counterpoint to the super low fat paradigm that people were living in. And folks, you know, many people seem to have success with leaning down and this sort of thing. But I like to think of this kind of large cognitive awareness of, oh my gosh, we are starving ourselves on empty calories and we need to eat like every hour and a half because our blood sugar, our glycemic index rises so high and our pancreas has to push out insulin to deal with that. And that causes the blood sugar to drop. So that's, you know, where people really get into this kind of roller coaster with their energy, and it impacts their sleep and their hormones and all of it. So I feel like what happened was societally, we then swung the pendulum the other way, which was way more nutrient dense. I feel like eating fat, whether it's animal or from plants, is really the fat of the land. It is, you're eating like at the densest component of the food chain. And I feel that we've needed to have almost this healing, especially those people who they or their parents, you know, really adhered to a very low fat diet for a long time. It's like you have to flood the body with these nutrients. And so that became the way that we swung in this other direction. And in my mind, the happy medium is when the pendulum swings to the middle and we bring a balance of high quality macronutrients into the body's nutritional experience. So what that means for keto and, like, you know, how that shows up today, the ketogenic diet is a diet that has been used therapeutically for different situations, different neurological presentations. And it's a very strict adherence to these macro ratios of fat and very moderate protein, which is different than the Atkins interpretation, and certainly very low carbohydrate. I would say my two biggest concerns with people trying to go keto and stay that way, my one first concern is the sustainability of it. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean the sustainability of someone's ability to adhere to it. Yeah. And that is, it's a tough thing to do. It's not an easy thing to adhere to. And in fact, if one is really wanting to work with a ketogenic practice, it's very important that they bring themselves out of ketosis periodically, because what happens is the body actually in this ketosis state where it's using ketones as fuel rather than leaning on the glucose in the bloodstream from carbohydrates. What happens is when someone stays in ketosis, the body begins to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. And they start putting on weight if they've even been able to get to ketosis. That's something that some people, hormonal issues, they can really have a hard time getting into ketosis. Mm-hmm. So to do it right, you actually have to have a lot of diet variation so that you're going in and out of ketosis and always kind of letting your body know it's not starving, and then putting it into stress periods, which ketosis is a stress period on the body. But a lot of people feel great when they're really running on ketones as their fuel source. So my first concern is sustainability of a person saying, I'm really going to stay committed to this lifestyle. And part of that sustainability concern is also the costs of doing this. Again, when you're eating the fat of the land, if you will, that does tend to be a rather costly way to eat, just on the pocketbook. But the other aspect to that is also the sustainability of what that means for the environment and you know, the degradation of land relative to trying to keep up with a lot of palm oil production, also you know, wide open cattle grazing that is not using good methods for restorative agriculture, which absolutely can be done with cattle grazing. But if everybody decided that they were going to really crank and eat, you know, a lot of beef fat or other hoofed animals, we would be getting into degradation of the environment in a big way. So I always kind of keep that in mind too. Yeah. And then finally, the other component of it is doing this in a manner that is sustainable for the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. And the gut microbiome really does well with having fiber in the diet. And the way that a lot of people think they are doing keto is really kind of more of a heavy protein, high fat Atkins kind of approach, mm-hmm. Where they're not bringing in good amounts of fiber. And one of the biggest things that I've seen with people when they say, oh, I'm doing keto, is they're like, I stopped going to the bathroom. Yeah. And the fiber that we have in different types of foods, and I'm not talking about a product like Metamucil, I'm talking about fiber that would be in, you know, organic, properly prepared grains, whole grains, certainly in different vegetables, root vegetables, and legumes. Legumes are an incredible source of fiber. When people take those types of foods out of their diet, what's happening is that they are not giving that fuel source to the colon lining itself. The cells of the colon actually appreciate that nutrition, as does the microbiome, the bacteria that are deep within the large intestine. And also that type of fiber is an incredible source for different short chain fatty acids that are converted from the consumption of that fiber by the bacteria. They're converted into new fatty acids. So you take a fiber and through bacterial processes, it's actually converted into a fatty acid. And those fatty acids have an incredible impact on neurotransmitter production, which is how, you know, we end up showing up emotionally, how we feel about the world. So to do a ketogenic diet properly requires going in and out of ketosis, mm-hmm. using really high quality foods. If you're going to do this, you know, it's really more about high fat, very moderate protein and low carbohydrate. I just don't see people really adhering to that. I mean, I certainly know healthcare practitioners and some health adherents who do. And, you know, many people feel great about it. But I think we also get back into the bioindividuality of where a person is in their life, what their unique microbiome is, and what their personal health challenges and health goals are. So it's something that I would not say it's a one size fits all.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. And so would you say that paleo is a little more manageable and a little more balanced?
I think it can be. And I, again, it's, I remember when I really was kind of going off of grains, and I had my family off of grains for over a year, but you know, we were still consuming carbs, and it was definitely a very paleo way of doing things for that time. I remember thinking, should I be eating this much almond flour? And is it okay for me to eat this much coconut flour?
Yeah.
You know, I think that our microbiome is incredibly malleable. I think that epigenetics is something that allows for people making distinct changes that maybe their genetic ancestry wouldn't have had, you know, in large amounts in their diet. So I'm not saying people can't make change and have it be okay. But I always do think about, okay, well, what would my people have been eating? And for my people, it would have, there was not coconut. We just didn't have it. And, you know, when I look at the genetics, and so some coconut's fine, but I was making a lot of coconut foods. And this aim for my husband, and so the genetics of our kids, it's like, gosh, I mean, should we be eating this much of this? So again, I like the concepts of really taking it back to simple ingredients, you know, vegetables, working with, you know, some of the nut flours and that sort of thing, you know, good clean protein sources, good unrefined cold pressed oil and fat sources. Mm-hmm. And then being mindful of, yeah, not going crazy with trying to create foods that were created around grains, but, you know, now transferring that into a different composition and eating that regularly. Of course, some of that's fine, but when you're eating that type of food regularly, you know, there's a bit of a concern there. And is that the right thing for you? And I, at the end of the day, Brigitte, I think the biggest thing is, you know, work with it for a while and see how your body feels with it. Mm-hmm. And be honest with yourself and pay attention to those signals of, you know what, I think it's time to make a change, or this is feeling great. And maybe I'll try bringing in some things that I thought maybe I needed to remove and see how I'm doing with it. Mm-hmm. I think that malleability relative to, you know, how we eat is such an important thing.
Yeah. And the body likes that too, right? The variety, yes. The variety in food, right? The microbiome,
that's right,
likes it anyway.
It loves it, yes.
And going back to fat, just for a second, fat is also super important for the brain, right?
Oh, so important. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's water and fat up here.
Yeah. Okay, so do you want to...
But to that point, Brigitte, I do want to say to that point, in the standard American diet, what we do eat, we tend to have a very omega-6 heavy diet.
Yes.
Where we're leaning on a lot of plant-derived oils. Mm-hmm. They are in the processed foods. People use them in their dressings and things like that. So that is too much, and they're very refined. So, you know, to create, let's say, safflower oil, mm-hmm. or sunflower oil or canola oil, in any of these instances, what we have is you have to really do a fair amount of processing on those components, and then they tend to be used in cooked products. Yeah. They're generally in clear bottles, and it's their polyunsaturated fatty acid structure that makes them incredibly prone to rancidity.
Yeah,
now we do not want. So when it comes to fats, a little bit of polyunsaturated fats in a very non-refined organic form, of course, that's great. But heavier, and this is a generalization, but I would say heavier working with, you know, like a great organic extra virgin olive oil for dressings, flax oil is great for dressings, and then more for cooking, more of the saturated fatty acid structure that can handle that heat. And that's where, of course, we get into the butter and ghee and coconut oil, palm oil, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I still don't understand why, you know, so many people love the Mediterranean diet, and they say that Italians, I mean, Mediterranean cultures, cook with olive oil, which is not
right. Yeah, you don't want it. You know, a lower heat on a more refined olive oil Mm-hmm. We can do that. I mean, you can do that. But yeah, I mean, you see people, they toss veggies in olive oil and then they broil them.
Yeah.
That's going to degrade that oil, and you don't want to do that. That's where working, you know, tossing in a little bit of like a ghee is a much better choice.
Yeah, totally agree. So what could be the problem with carbs?
Well, we eat too many of them for starters. Uh-huh. And by that, I mean highly refined carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, you know, that's when the marketing really got going around this concept of snacking. Yeah. And that's where we really started bringing in so many refined carbohydrate foods, you know, from things like Twinkies to, you know, chips, and certainly more refined breads and snacky type foods. Yeah. And these are things that every time you do that, every time you consume one of those foods, it does the roller coaster for you. Yeah. And it engages that. You know, they tend to, of course, to have different flavor enhancements that make you crave them and want more of them. You know, they're excitotoxins to the brain. Plus, you add to it what it does to your blood sugar. And without this awareness, you get hooked into the pattern of it. Yeah. I certainly didn't have that awareness as a kid. I didn't know that, you know, eating the Doritos or having, you know, just pancakes for breakfast with some Mrs. Butterworth's syrup, if we can call it that, you know, that what that was doing to my blood sugar, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. My parents didn't know. So you begin to have this awareness of, whoa, wait a minute, that just doesn't feel like that's giving me a long burn of energy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we need to really hit bottom in terms of how we feel before we engage a significant change. And so when it comes to carbohydrates, I would say that we as a culture have been fully indoctrinated into the consumption of refined carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And it is something that the human body, this is just totally new territory. Mm-hmm. And if a person has a genetic tendency and a microbiome tendency based off of the different species they have in their gut, to really be able to withstand long periods of starvation, you know, like not much food at all, mm-hmm. if that's the kind of people they came from, when they eat the standard American diet of refined foods, refined carbohydrates, eating them frequently, that's really going to lend itself toward obesity, you know, this holding on of weight, which is great if, you know, you're only eating two or three times a week, but that doesn't work so well when you have this chronic availability of food and this desire to eat it because of the excitotoxins and the, you know, the changes that happen with the blood sugar. So genetics and the microbiome together can really play quite a part in our cravings and our response and the way that our body looks and the way that we feel. So I think the smartest thing to do is to just put in that stopgap of, I'm taking out the refined carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start eating in a way that I know I feel satiated by the meal, and not eating to the point of being stuffed. That's not good for your belly. It's not good for your body. But allowing a little bit of time to enjoy that meal so that your blood sugar naturally starts to come up, which will, in its design, begin to slow you down on eating too much for a given meal, and then seeing how you do. You know, it's such a tremendous feeling to begin to feel like, wait a minute, I'm not having those crashes in my blood sugar. I'm not having these crashes in my energy where I feel like at 2 p.m. I need to have a cup of coffee or some chocolate or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you. So I think maybe it's time to switch to our other topic and talk about the anti-nutrients.
Sure, yes. This is a big one.
Yeah, unless you have more to talk about, I'm sure you do, about...
No, I feel like that covered it pretty well.
Okay, good. So anti-nutrients, you know, what comes to mind is all the bad stuff that are in so-called healthy things that look healthy.
Yeah.
Things like oxalate, I don't know if the pronunciation is right.
Oxalate, yeah. Lectins,
purine, lectin, phytic acid, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So what do you know about that? Because not everybody is familiar with that, I think.
Right. You know, and this is one of the challenges when a person says, well, I'm going to start eating more whole grains and I'm going to start eating more beans and I'm going to start eating, you know, lots of veggies and this sort of thing. Certainly, all of those foods have incredible attributes, but all of them also have these components that have been called anti-nutrients. And it's interesting, in the nutrition class that I teach, I really try and take a little bit of the heat out of that by showing that these anti-nutrients oftentimes have good benefit for the body. Uh-huh. They can have attributes in what they do that are not completely bad. However, when we eat a lot of them, and maybe we have problems with our digestion, maybe we are in a stress state where we could really be doing with a lot more minerals in our diet that are actually getting into our system and working for us. I feel that what we can do to decrease them without saying, oh my gosh, I can't eat that food. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a better way to go, where you leave it a little bit, but you're really kind of handling it also. Mm-hmm. And so one of the biggest ones that people have talked about recently is lectins. And there's Dr. Stephen Gundry, and he's written a book about this, and he has a supplement line that helps to degrade these lectins. And they're carbohydrate binding proteins that are common in different foods. Some of the nightshade family foods, they can have lectins, different grains and beans can have lectins. And in fact, gluten, the scary anti-nutrient gluten, is a lectin. It's in the family of lectins. And so rather than taking the approach of, well, you can't eat zucchini and you can't eat tomatoes, you know, you can't eat these grains because, you know, they're lectins, I would much prefer that we work with different preparation techniques, you know, so that we can enjoy those foods for the good benefit that they offer. So when it comes to lectins, one of the great ways that our ancestors got around that, and of course, I'm sure lectins is a pretty new term, but there may have been an awareness about, gosh, if we don't do this, things don't seem to feel right in the body. And we notice that over time, you know, the kids develop certain issues, you know, generationally. I don't know. I wasn't there. However, there are things that have happened around certain types of foods that can help to degrade these lectins. And one of the things is fermentation. Mm-hmm. And so souring bread, you know, souring grain to make a sourdough bread, that's a great way to degrade lectins. Mm-hmm. And baking is going to help to degrade it too. But really one of the really great ways to degrade lectins in beans and different vegetables is to cook with a pressure cooker.
That's what I
heard. Yeah, so that's great. And these lectins, they tend to be in the skin and in the seeds of, you know, different fruits and vegetables. Uh-huh. Obviously vegetables don't have seeds, but the what you want to do then is it tends to be in those types of foods that are eaten out of season. So eating something at its peak ripeness is inherently going to have a much lower lectin content than if you were to eat something, you know, like a strawberry in the middle of winter or something. Mm-hmm. So eating in season, you know, if you really feel that this is something you want to avoid, then you can, you know, take the skin off and pull the seeds from, say, tomatoes. Yeah. That's going to have a really big reduction in lectin content. And then the preparation. So the soaking and fermenting of grains and beans and nuts and seeds also. And then you can dehydrate at a low heat, and then you have what are known as crispy nuts, or you could of course turn that into bread. Like I've got some, you know, naturally soured rye bread that I made, taken a loaf to my hairdresser today. So, you know, you can do these methods that really help to degrade these kind of intense protein structures, which is what lectins are.
Uh-huh. I see. Do you want to say something else about the other anti-nutrients?
Yeah, you know, phytic acid's another one. And phytic acid is, again, common in a lot of different foods. And the problem, or I should say one of the challenges of phytic acid, is it can bind to different minerals. And so, like with lectins and with phytic acid and oxalates, you know, with all of these, I think people who are vegetarian and like pretty committed to their vegetarianism and certainly veganism, yeah, I almost feel like they have to be even more aware of this.
Yeah.
So phytic acid, as I say, binds to different minerals. And so again, soaking, fermentation totally breaks down the phytic acid content of foods. And makes everything just more easily digested. It's a pre-digestion method. So to me, it just has such tremendous benefit to, you know, soak your grains, soak your beans, ferment them a bit too. But when a person is vegetarian or vegan and they're not bringing in a huge mineral content from maybe dairy products and different meat products, it's really extra important that that work of reducing the phytic acid content is an important part to play.
Yeah. And one word maybe on the oxalate.
And oxalates are one of those that, you know, some people have no problem with them and other people do. And that's one that I feel I don't focus quite as heavily on that with what I teach, because I just think that a lot of people don't actually get them much in their diet, because a lot of people eat a rather refined diet. Mm-hmm. And if a person does, you know, begin to note that, you know, they've got issue with, you know, stone formation or anything like that, that's when they really have to, you know, back that up and start doing some research on making sure that they reduce those oxalate rich foods in the diet. Spinach is super high that way. And it's tough because so many of these foods have great nutrient quality, but many people will eat these foods raw. And oftentimes these foods, a lot of the issues, another one is goitrogens, which are naturally occurring components in the brassica family. And the brassica family is like broccoli and cauliflower and kale and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so many people do these smoothies where they'll put in raw spinach and raw kale and put it into, you know, a high intensity blender. And if those foods were just cooked, that would have made a big difference in terms of these kind of more challenging attributes. So I, to that point, definitely when it comes to brassica foods, kales, things like that, cook those guys. And the same with spinach. Spinach should be sauteed with, you know, in some ghee with maybe some lemon juice. And sea salt and garlic, that will make the nutrients in that spinach much more bioavailable to your body.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's definitely a thought that anything raw is healthier than cooked, but it's not always the case, right?
It isn't. And again, it's this, cooking is a pre-digestion, right?
Yeah.
And we don't have the robust innate enzymatic action that like a gorilla or a cow has. Yeah. We're just not designed like that. And so for us to be able to extract what is in there, we just don't, and even our hydrochloric acid production, you know, especially if a person is stressed or if they're on different medications that are blocking or inhibiting that hydrochloric acid production, their ability to break down the minerals and the proteins is quite compromised. So especially if someone is making changes and they're feeling weak and debilitated, just a small amount of raw food, but a lot of things that need to be, you know, cooked. And there's a reason that in Chinese medicine, you know, the convalescing foods, the foods that really are given to people, you know, women after childbirth or after mm-hmm. surgery or, you know, some kind of long convalescing after an illness, it's things like congee, which is different grains and just cook for a super long time with water, just yeah. slow simmer, maybe throwing in some different herbs and spices to that, maybe even some medicinal herbs, maybe cooking with some broth. Mm-hmm. This is something that allows someone who has been like at their qi and blood level so spent. Uh-huh. This is easy nutrition. And Brigitte, I tell you, I've been doing this long enough that I just feel like a lot of people, even in their normal daily way of being, are running on fumes.
Yeah.
And to have that person go into, yeah, eating a super cold, raw diet, you know, if they're coming from a standard American diet, they are going to feel better for a while. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the digestive wherewithal, certainly in the state that they're in, to be able to get much from that over the long haul. I'm making a generalization here. I understand that. But really, for the type of stress that I see bodies under these days, really coming from that perspective of what can I do to support my body through nutrition in a way that's going to make it so that those nutrients get into me. Yeah. And that is where working with long, you know, prepared grains this way, that's very nutrient, very qi building for yeah. the body. But then soups too. And stews, things that allow the more fibrous content
yeah.
of vegetables, you know, to be broken down, because we don't have the dentition for it. We're not cows, and we don't have the strong hydrochloric acid and enzymatic capacity
yeah.
for that. And those are things that, yes, with stress, illness, and age, they decline. And yeah. so it's really important. It's not just what you eat, it's how it was prepared.
Definitely. So maybe trying to eat congee, is it congee? Is that how you pronounce it?
Congee, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To eat that once a week would be amazing.
I think it would be so good. And the thing that's neat about Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine is that, you know, really both of them, you know, in the Western paradigm, we really put things into broad categories, you know, so you say, okay, here are your carbohydrates. And that can range from anything from a Twinkie to long grain organic brown rice that's been soaked and fermented and cooked in an Instant Pot. That all falls under carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. Versus in Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, the appreciation of the energetic qualities of different types of foods.
Yeah.
And so the energetic quality of, say, millet is quite different than the energetic quality of rye or of brown rice. So having that awareness And this is information, you know, that just with a little bit of internet searching, you can see what these qualities are and what you would want to bring up, you know, to really nourish within yourself.
Yes, the warming foods and the cooling foods. And that's important to be aware of during this, in the seasons, right? In the summer, coconut water is okay, but not in the winter, right?
Exactly. And I would even go so far as to say coconut oil. I feel like coconut oil has a little bit more of a cooling quality.
Yeah.
Versus like a ghee.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the season. I heard that fat is better in the winter and carbs better in the summer, which is amazing.
And, you know, and it makes sense. You know, I've kind of alluded to this a couple times, how the fat is a very yin essence, deep nutrition. And in the winter time, you know, you think about, what do the squirrels do? What do the trees do? All, you know, everybody hibernates and all the energy goes back to the roots. And this is a time to really kind of rebuild your energies. Of course, you know, in the modern setting, we keep going, you know, 24/7 anyway, but it really is a time of quietude, of building up. And then the spring is when the sprouts come and the leaves come and, you know, the activity comes.
Yeah.
And in the summertime, this is our full chi expression. And if we really nourished ourselves well through the winter, as we work through into the summer, it's a great time to absorb the nutrients of the earth. You know, the summertime is just a time when it's just easier to live in your skin. You know, it's the temperature around you is warmer. It doesn't require as much to just keep going.
Right.
And so,
and the sun, right?
The sun, totally. Yeah. We just don't need that deep level of nutrition generally. You know, again, if you've had a baby or, you know, you've had something that you're really convalescing from, of course, you need to address that. That's your season within the season. But generally speaking, yes. And then as we move into the fall, that's where, you know, the days get shorter, they get cooler, you know, the light's not as available. And so that's when we start moving into eating more nourishing, you know, deep nourishment foods.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. So do you think you still have time to address two questions that we got from listeners?
Sure.
One was, how can we create healthy mealtime habits, you know, for family time? And then the connection between nutrition and culture, or food and culture, and would that help in times of to maintain that connection in times of oppression? So two different topics, if you can address those, that would be great.
For sure. You know, I feel like I am living the challenge of the first one. When my kids were younger, obviously it was just easier for me to do as I wanted to do around their diet. And they're 14 and 16 now. And one of my kids is very independent and she just wants to do it her way. And it's this, I find that at this point, you know, for that independent streak, that it's more about educating as to why we do things at our house the way that we do, and incorporating, you know, periods of time. Like yesterday, there was a fundraiser for her school, and it was at a fast food restaurant, which, like, that place has been in the town that as long as I've been here, I've never been there. Of course, I mean, it's just doesn't even enter my radar.
Yeah.
But I knew that was important for her, and I said, "Yeah, this is not happening regularly." And this is why I want you to understand my concern about, you know, the fats that are being used and, you know, this sort of thing. So at this age, I feel like that education and giving some space around making some autonomous decisions is, it's just what you have to do. Now with my son, who's actually older, he will eat whatever I put in front of him. And he's just happy to have someone give him food. So it's easier for his type of personality. Mm-hmm. When they were younger, that engagement of, okay, well, what kind of recipe would you like to work with? What would you like to create, you know, in the crock pot or whatever? And then bringing them in on, you know, what that is. That was more enjoyable for them when they were younger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that they're older, it's just not something, you know, that appeals to them. So I think that in that question, it has to do with age appropriately educating the kids on why you're doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Because as they get older, they're going to be more and more on their own, over at friends' homes, maybe having some cash in their pocket and making decisions around, you know, the foods and beverages that they're consuming. And if they have that working knowledge of why this choice maybe isn't the best choice for them, and maybe what they could do differently, that to me is the most important part of it, is helping them to see why.
Yeah.
So that, I think it just changes as, you know, you move through time. And I get it, this, you know, because I remember in the question, it's like, gosh, I just kind of make my own food and kind of go shuttle myself over here and kind of let everybody do whatever else they want to do. And in doing so, I get it. You know, if we get off on our timing with meals, I've been known to do that also. Or if I'm in a hurry to do something, it's like, you guys are on your own, I have to go do this. So, you know, you have to allow that you're going to have times like that. But if that's the model, then making sure that what's in the house, for the most part, is really good components for them to work with. Like, no one in my family is going to turn their nose up to, you know, a grilled cheese sandwich that's made with, you know, really high quality raw cheese on sprouted sourdough bread that's cooked in ghee. Mm-hmm. Like, who says no to that? And so unless you have, you know, issue with dairy or wheat or whatever. Mm-hmm. So having the good base components and then letting them have their freedom with it, I think is also an important part there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And then food culture and to be stronger in times of oppression. Well, some cultures that do better if they stay close to their food traditions.
Yes, yeah. I think that is so powerful and so beautiful. and if a person has that, I think that is one of the most grounding ways to look after yourself.
It's comfort food, right?
Yes. And yeah. The thing about comfort food, so for me growing up, pancakes were a comfort food. Mm-hmm. And as I've gotten older, and I know the feeling of the roller coaster energy, for a long time, I really just didn't have an interest in pancakes, because even if I was making it with like a whole wheat, you know, it still was this type of thing. Mm-hmm. So over time, like on Mother's Day, I made pancakes for all of us, but I use sprouted grain as my flour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whole fat milk and lots of butter. So it's very stabilizing to the blood sugar. It's a completely different version of a pancake than the pancakes I ate as a kid.
Yeah.
So in that framework of working with these culturally sensitive to us foods, thinking about how you can make them better. Say it's lasagna. Well, you know, then work with, you know, for sure an organic, maybe imported from Italy noodle to begin with. Make sure you're using excellent, you know, very high quality ingredients, you know, the best cheeses, you know, grass-fed meats, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then really stuff it with a lot of vegetables. Probably more than, you know, maybe was the original design of the recipe.
Yeah.
There are just ways that we can work with things that we really love, but make them better. I mean, I've worked with families where the kids are very averse to bringing in more whole food nutrition. And, you know, all they'll want to eat is macaroni and cheese. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I say, okay, well, at the very least, let's maybe, rather than just working with, you know, the most base ingredients, let's start working with some grass-fed butter in that sauce preparation. Let's see if we can maybe cook those noodles in some good chicken broth that has gelatin, you know, when it's, mm-hmm. So different ways that we can slowly but surely begin to make those foods more nutrient dense while still meeting that emotional content, but looking after ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really good. Thank you. So, I think that is wonderful. Sarika, thank you so much again for doing another interview with us. And I think we have plenty of inspiration now to eat a healthier diet.
Wonderful. Thank you, Brigitte. And yes, there's just so much creativity around food and nutrition. And my gosh, don't be afraid of it. Just have fun with it.
Yeah. And if you have a good congee recipe, I'll put it in the resources section.
Fantastic. Yes. These are things that, you know, you can find online. I remember Paul Pritchford, Healing with Whole Foods. Uh-huh. He was a fella who really took the idea of working with nutrition from a Chinese medicine angle. So yeah. that's definitely one book that folks may want to look at. But we are in the age now of being able to work with the internet and say, you know, okay, what is this? Let's see.
Yes. So this is Brigitte Mouchet with the Solari Wellness Series. Thank you for listening and take good care, because it's more fun to be well.